All right, we're ready for chapters 19 and 20 of Deuteronomy. This is our outline that we are following, that we borrow from Wiersbe. We are in the second section, the second sermon, as Moses is looking within as per this outline, and we are focusing on the judgments, which starts with this one tonight in chapter 19 and will carry us through the end of this sermon, which is chapter 26. All right, we are in that second speech, reviewing the law as per that little outline there. So let's get underway and look at our review of our chapters, where we've been. So we have a number of chapters to remember, 18 of those. Chapter 1. All right, review from Sinai to Kadesh. Chapter 2. Very good. The wilderness wanderings and the victory over Sihon. 3. Victory over Og, the division of the land, and Moses forbidden to enter. And then this next chapter, 4, ends the first sermon on the note of obedience. Yes, the necessity of obedience. That's the first sermon. Now we start the second sermon, which is where we're still in that sermon. A little longer information here. But chapter 5 was, all right, the Ten Commandments. Chapter 6 kind of backs up a little bit, not as specific. All right, the place and the warning and the meaning of the law, kind of an overview of the purpose of the law. Chapter 7, a separate people. Chapter 8, same principle we saw in chapter 4. Chapter 9, yeah, pride and self-righteousness. You're not going to enter the land because of yourself. We're going to see more about that even in our study tonight. Hints at that all along. Chapter 10. Mercy and obedience. Chapter 11. Love and obey the Lord. You see obedience mentioned time and again. Chapter 4, chapter 8, chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 12. All right, that's the chapter that we keep going back to that talks about the place that God chooses. Chapter 13. All right, destruction of those that lead to idolatry. And 14. All right, very good. Chapter 15. All right, the release, seventh year release. Chapter 16, the annual feast. Chapter 17. All right, and then chapter 18 last time. Levite portions and the heathen practices and a prophet like unto Moses. I don't know if that helps you or not. That helps me to review through that. You won't remember every chapter, but there should be from that review every time something come up that when we start talking about the place that God chooses, oh yeah, that's over in Deuteronomy 12. A prophet like Moses, that's Deuteronomy 18. What put me on to doing that, I've told this before, but just as a little footnote, many years ago, this is nearly 40 years ago, I was in a meeting at a place where the preacher did that constantly. And we'd go somewhere to visit, go to someone's home, and when they'd answer the door, he's quite dry in his presentation. When they'd answer the door, he might say, Deuteronomy 12, and they would spit out what that chapter was about. And go to the next place we'd go eat or visit, and he would say, Numbers chapter 1, and they would spit out the chapter title to that. I was impressed, and hopefully we're learning a little from that as well. All right, question number one, what is chapter 19 about? Cities of refuge. Question number two, what's the purpose of those? All right, yes, they can flee there for safety. All right, let's talk about the cities of refuge first. There's three things that happen in chapter 19. There's the cities of refuge. This is not our first time to visit that. We're going to list the passages in a moment that you may want to put in your margin. And then also the respecting landmarks. And then we're going to have concerning witnesses, true witnesses and false witnesses. How do we establish something as being true? Now, you may already have this over at Deuteronomy 4 and at Numbers 35. You probably don't have this at Joshua 20, unless you have it from last time. But it would be helpful, I think, to put in the margin of your text at Numbers 35, these other three passages, and at Deuteronomy 4, the other three passages, and you know the rule by now. And the value of that to me is that when I'm studying Deuteronomy 4, I know where to go in other places finding information on the cities of refuge. When I'm at Deuteronomy 19 tonight, I have the other three passages to go to for references. Hopefully that's helpful to you. So anyway, you might make a note on that. What we learn from Numbers 35 is the instructions, that's a little more thorough than any of the other instructions that we have. There's more, we have new information tonight in Deuteronomy 19, but just a review of what we've seen, Numbers 35 gives the instructions to establish six cities of refuge. Here is their purpose. Here's how that's going to be conducted. Here's what's going to happen if a person flees there and they have not committed murder with intent. But if they have, here's what's to be done. We're going to go through all of that again here tonight. Now in Deuteronomy 4, we've already been through that in this cycle. So in Deuteronomy 4, there were three established, and we'll flag which those three are, were established on the east side of the Jordan River. So they already have three established. So in Deuteronomy 19, we have three are to be established on the west side. Now, they're not on the west side yet. But once they get across, once they've made the conquest, that doesn't come to the book of Joshua, there will be three more to be established, making a total of six. We're also going, here's the new information. We're going to learn from Deuteronomy chapter 19 that even three more could be established if needed, making a total of nine. And we'll get that and flag that in a moment as we go along. Now, Joshua 20 is a very important passage. One is, this is where they're established, number one. And number two, we have all six identified there. So we know exactly when I'm over in Numbers 35, which six we're talking about. And when I come to Deuteronomy 19 and we have six mentioned, I know which six we're talking about because Joshua 20 flags that for me. Make sense? All right. You need those four passages listed somewhere. All right, let's get underway with verses 1 to 3, and then we're going to go to our map and look for the six cities. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that we're going to revisit this thing about pride. Remember the chapter we had on it is not by your, about pride and overconfidence that you think it's with your power and your might, etc. God subtly warns the people constantly, this is by my power and by my might, and I've delivered it. And you notice this in verse 1. When the Lord has cut off the nations, not when you've cut off the nations, when the Lord has cut off the nations, I'm at verse 1, whose land the Lord your God is giving you. God cut them off, God's giving it to you. And you go and dispossess them, and you dwell in their houses and their cities, etc. So notice again that subtle thing of God did this, God is going to do this, it's by His power and by His might. Well, when that happens, he said, in other words, when you get across the land and you take, we conquer the land on the other side, you shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of the land. Now they already have three from chapter 4. So this is three more in addition to that. They're not named here. Let's go ahead and get verse 3 and then we're going to look at the map. What does verse 3 tell you about the cities? We saw this in principle before, but seems to be emphasized more here. Yeah, where they're to be located, prepare roads and to divide them into three parts of the territory. In other words, divide the territory. You don't put all three cities in the north or put all three cities in the south, but make them evenly spread, number one. And number two, make the roads make them accessible by roads and maintain the roads for easy access. In other words, you don't have an easy road to this city over here, but to the city of refuge, make it a pig pass so that it's difficult and a man can't run there. He's going to be fleeing. He's going to be running. So maintain the roads and keep them prepared so that you have this city of refuge. You may be the one that needs that city of refuge at some point in light of verse 5. Now let's see what we've got so far. The three cities circled here are the ones already established in Deuteronomy 4. And there are three more that are to be established, which are being discussed in verses 1 through 3. They're not named, but they are named in Joshua 20. So up in the corner here, we have Joshua 20 and Deuteronomy 4. Three in the yellow have already been established, Deuteronomy 4. The other three are going to be established over in Joshua 20. So those are the six cities. And so notice how they're spread out. You have Kedesh up in the north, and you have Shechem in the middle, and then you have Hebron in the south, and the same thing on the east side that we've already talked about, Golan, Ramoth, Gilead, and Bezer. These are the six cities. Make sense? These are the cities of refuge. So no matter where you were in this shaded area of the nation of Israel, you had a city that would be your city of refuge. So if you're down here in Simeon, you're going to run to Hebron. That's the closest place. If you're up in Gad, you're going to run to Ramoth-Gilead. That's the closest place. Now, let's talk about the purpose of these cities, verses 4 through 7. This is a case of manslaughter. Verse 3 had said a manslayer should flee there. A case of a manslayer fleeing there, verse 4, that he may live. In other words, once he gets to this city of refuge, this city that's a sanctuary city, as we would call it in our day and time, they're safe. They cannot be attacked. They cannot be killed. So at verse 4, whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally. So God makes a distinction in killing that's intentional, as our laws do, and killing that is unintentional. There may be consequences, but there is a distinction. Not having hated him in the past. We call that premeditation. Now he gives a for instance. What's the for instance in verse 5? Here's a case in point. This might happen. All right, man may be chopping wood and his axe head falls off or flies off and he hits another man and it strikes him so that he dies, and he's going to flee for safety there that he might live. So now let's look at verse 6 and let's talk about the avenger of blood and define the avenger of blood. This is not the first time we've seen the avenger of blood. We saw him in Numbers 35. We talked briefly about him, but we'll talk a little more about him right here. Lest, he said, the avenger of blood, whoever that is, we'll come back and define him in a moment. He needs to flee to the city, lest the avenger of blood, while his anger is hot, pursue the manslayer and overtake him. So who is the avenger of blood? It seems to be one, though he's never identified. There is not a text that I know of that talks about the avenger of blood and identifies that the avenger of blood would be XYZ. There are indications and hints. And let me give you what those are. The word that is translated avenger is translated a number of ways in the New Testament. Redeemer is one of the words. Do you remember when Job talked about that declaration of faith? Job 19 talks about my redeemer. That's Goel, same word. Same word right here. God was his avenger of blood. God was his redeemer. God was his savior. The word is translated near kinsman. In Ruth, let's turn over to Ruth 2 just for a moment. And I'll give you some other references. We've got time, I think, to do this and make some sense. Let's go to the book of Ruth, chapter 2, and in verse 20. Naomi, speaking of Boaz, said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed is he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives." Same word. Same word. Close relative. Chapter 3, verse 9 of Ruth. Chapter 3, verse 12. Same terminology is used. A close relative. So we take, and then let me add you one more, Leviticus 25, 47 to 49, where if a brother has sold himself into slavery, and I'm paraphrasing. So here is a Hebrew who sells himself to someone in slavery, then his redeemer, that is his nearest of kin, mentioned, by the way, in the context is close family, it might be a brother, might be an uncle, might be some the nearest of kin, would go and redeem him. Here's our word. Our word that is translated here, the avenger of blood. So what's our conclusion? It's the nearest of kin who is then charged with executing wrath upon the person. So if you were one who had been killed accidentally, you may, and verse 6, in your anger, whether you were supposed to or not, go after him because it was your job to defend your family. You go after him, get ready to kill him, but he flees for safety. If it was premeditated, he flees for safety, makes it to the city of refuge, he's going to be killed anyway. But the avenger of blood was the nearest of kin who was to execute that judgment. Does that make sense? Same word that we found in these other places. Anyway, now we're still talking about the purpose. So he's fleeing from not just anybody, he's fleeing from the avenger of blood, that nearest of kin that's seeking the refuge, seeking the revenge. Another argument that it may be that nearest of kin not only is the word, but the anger is hotter with him than with just anyone else. Now, every Israelite should have been upset that somebody died, but not like family. Not like family. Family is going to be extremely upset. Now, verse 6 says, because the way is long, he killed him. In other words, we've got to have a city close by because if it's too far, he's going to be overtaken by the avenger of blood and be killed. So we've got to have cities of refuge is the point. And so separate three cities for yourself. Make sense? All right, now verses 8 to 10. This is new information. By new information, it's new compared to Numbers 35 and Deuteronomy 4. We haven't got to Joshua 20 yet, but it's not even in Joshua 20. So this is new information. And here's the new information. Now, if the Lord your God enlarge your territory, I don't think that's talking about we're on the east side and God enlarge it by us going over on the west side, but I think it's beyond that territory that God has promised them. Does that make sense? If you were to expand beyond that, in other words, have more territory, then he swore to your fathers and gives you land which you promised to give your fathers. And if you keep all, key word, the commandments to do them as I commanded you and walk in his ways. I missed a word. Always in his ways. You walk always in his ways. Then you shall add three more cities besides these three cities. What three cities? The ones just mentioned on the west side back at verse 2. So we already have three. We're adding three. This is not high math. We have three. We've added three. That's six. You add three more. That makes nine. Did they ever have nine? No. The territory expanded briefly and temporarily under David and under Solomon. But that was temporary. And it didn't last long. So there never came a point where there was a need for more than the six. We don't have a record. If there ever was more than six, we don't have a record of that. As far as the biblical record, we don't have anything but the six that are mentioned in Joshua 20. Does that make sense to you? But God had made provision if you were to expand. And now here's the key to the expanding. Let's go back and I flagged these for you as we went through verse 9. If you keep all the commandments and you walk always in his ways. Did they keep all of his commandments? No. Did they always walk in his ways? No. Maybe that's the reason they didn't expand. Does that make sense? All right. Now that gets us through verse 9. So you're going to add three more if the territory increases. And so what I'm noticing, something that never comes to play, God had put in provision in case. God had some in case laws. Not that this is going to happen, but in case it happens, here's what we do. We do that quite often. We have some in case circumstance. In case this happens, here's what we're going to do. 11 to 13 now. One who kills intentionally, we call that first degree murder. What happens here? He's going to flee to the city. You would too, wouldn't you? And to one of these cities, he's not going to be safe. Then the elders of his city, I take that to be the elders from where he was. It may refer to the elders of the city to where he fled. I take it to refer to the elders from which he came. So let's say he came from Jericho and he has fled down to Hebron. The elders from Jericho would go to Hebron and have him brought out and delivered him to the hand of the avenger of blood that he might die. So it was premeditated. It's obvious it's premeditated. He killed him. He's fled for safety. He's not safe. He's going to be killed. Turn him over to the avenger of blood, and he takes care of him, and he kills him. Now, verse 13 gives me some insight. You don't have any pity on him. In other words, he's committed premeditated murder. So don't get out in front of the courthouse and protest when they're about to execute him and talk about the love of God and forgiveness. You don't do that. You have no pity on him because he committed premeditated murder. But there's something else that I wanted to flag at the end of verse 13. What do you see? Say again. Punishment fits the crime. What else? Exactly. This reminds me of Deuteronomy 6. God gave the commandments that it may go well with you. Remember that? That was Deuteronomy 6. It'll go well if you do the commandments of God. That was in the scope of the commandments. All right? If you don't follow this principle of executing the criminal like he should be, it's not going to go well with you. In other words, suppose they take a soft view and say, well, we don't want to kill the criminal. We don't want to have two wrongs. We don't want to put him to death when he's put somebody else to death. We lost two people that way. So we're going to just let him live, but let him live in the city of refuge. It's not going to go well for the nation. It doesn't go well for our nation either. All right. Now that's the cities of refuge. Questions or comments before we leave that? Now say that again. Your question again? If he kills an innocent man, yes, he's guilty of murder. That is the avenger. But the rule was he has to flee to safety so that he wouldn't be killed. And so... there. I don't know that was murder. I don't know, because I think he has to flee to safety. That's a good question. I'm understanding now what you're asking. He's to flee for safety lest that innocent blood be shed. I'm trying to think of a statement in Numbers 35. It'd have to be in Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 5, or Deuteronomy 4 or Joshua 20. I don't know. I'm not sure that he would be guilty of premeditated murder. I'm not sure. Because verse 10 is telling me he had to flee so that he would be safe. He's got to get there so he'd be safe. And so he doesn't dally around. He needs to be running for safety. So that's where he's going to be safe, is to be in that city. Because the avenger of blood's going to go after him. There's nothing that I remember in any of these texts. I'm thinking of Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 4, Joshua 20, and Deuteronomy 19. Those four passages, I don't know of anything that was condemning the avenger of blood and going after him. I don't remember that. There may have been. I just don't remember that. Good question, though. Real good question. All right. Let's talk about respecting landmarks. God's just, through Moses, just laying out, here's some rules we're going to have to abide by when we get across over into the land. And so, respect the ancient landmarks. Only one verse is devoted to this. You shall not remove the neighbor's landmarks, which men of old have set in your inheritance, which you'll inherit in the land, that God is giving you to possess. There's that God giving you hint. Who are the men of old? Some have argued... as you well know, that there are those who argue that Moses didn't write Deuteronomy. And one of their arguments against Moses' authorship is that this had to be written much later than Moses, because this is after they're already in the land and the boundaries have been set. I don't think that holds water. Some think, and this may be true, that verse 14 could have two different interpretations. One is that the boundaries of the cities and the lands may already have been set when they conquer the land, as you may buy a piece of property today and the boundaries have already set, though somebody else owned it before you, and you respect those boundaries. Now, you could buy land and sell land, but you respect the boundaries when you're taking this territory. That may be boundaries that were set by the heathens that were already there. Or it may be speaking in kind of a prophetic perfect, as if it's already done, but speaking in the future. Once you get in the land and boundaries are set, then respect those boundaries. I don't have a problem with it being prophetic perfect, speaking of things that are not as though they are, the terminology of Romans 4. Now, I may have confused you more on that, but the point that we're going to leave that is just simply you don't steal your neighbor's property by moving the property line. If the property line is this pile of rocks, then you don't in secret move the pile of rocks over further, so you just gained a few acres. That's stealing. Don't remove the ancient landmarks. Let's talk about the witnesses now, and this is not new information. This will be repeated time and again. So in beginning at verse 15, what is the law? It has to be two or three witnesses. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin. In other words, one man rises up and said he's guilty of sin, he needs to be punished. It may be put out of the camp, or it may be even death, whatever the punishment may be. It's by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word should be established. Even New Testament principles, remember that in Matthew chapter 18, that someone brings a charge, it should be established by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word be established. Now verse 16 to 21, there may be a false witness to arise. And here is a big discouragement to that, to say the least. That if a false witness arises and testifies against a man of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy go to the priest and the judges. Now, exactly what role the priest played versus the judges, we read of judges who executed judgment and priests who execute judgment. And I'm about to tell you, I'm going to exhaust my knowledge of the role of the priest and the judges. They both executed judgment. And now you have all my knowledge on that. I don't know the distinction between the judges and the priest and who did what. Now, there may be a passage I'm missing. I'm just missing it. I just don't know where that passage is. But anyway, my point that I want you to see, though, and this is important, when we get down to verse 21 in a moment, that there are some things that were executed by judges or by priests. It's not just by any individual who decides, I want to do something. You know, you need to die for, you did something worthy of death. You were caught in adultery. I believe I'll be the one to stone you. No. There were judges and priests that executed judgment. Make sense? So keep that in mind at verse 17. They'll go before the priest. Now, what's going to happen when they go before the priest and the judges? They're going to require, inquire diligently. Some New King James, remember they're updated every year, so yours may differ. Some of them say diligently, some say carefully. They're going to make careful inquiry to find out who's telling the truth. Now then, verse 19, this is really going to discourage being a false witness. What's going to happen? It'll be done. Whatever he was thinking would needed to be done. I want to bring testimony against this man because I want him to be stoned, then he's going to be stoned. I want him to be cast out of the camp, I'm going to be cast out of the camp. That'll discourage false witness real quick. That you can't find any other witnesses and you're bearing testimony, then it's going to happen to you. Now look at verse 20. Those that remain shall, you might underline, hear and be afraid or fear. Reminds me of, think of a New Testament passage. Bingo. Acts 5, verse 11. When they dropped dead, the congregation feared. Acts 5, 11. And hereafter, they shall not again commit such evil among them. All you need is one false witness to rise up and say, this man did something worthy of death, and he goes before the priest and for the judge, and next thing you know, he's being stoned to death. Don't you know the word's going to get out real quick? Better be careful bringing charges. Don't you do that unless you've got some more witnesses. And that discourages it. Now let's talk about verse 21. Add a little information here. Your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So what is that about? Well, all of that had reference to was punishment is to be commensurate with the offense. In other words, a person has committed this minor offense, you don't give them the maximum punishment. And that's true in our law. You don't have a parking offense and then you put away for life. That just doesn't happen that way. But you make the punishment fit the crime. So it's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Some took that to mean that, okay, you poke me in the eye, I'm going to poke you in the eye. You slap me, I'm going to slap you. You stole my calf, I'm going to steal your calf. And that didn't give any authority for that. That's why I flagged verse 17. This was to be executed by the judges. So go back to Exodus 21 just for a moment. And we saw the same principle, because I think that's powerfully important. Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 to 27, you see that again. And that was to be verse 22, the judges determined that. So again, the judges were the ones to execute that. So you steal from me, something may be taken from you, but I don't just go get it, even under Old Testament law. Judges were to execute that. Does that make sense? So there was never in the Old or New Testament a retaliation law that I'm going to retaliate and do you like you've done me. And some have argued that. And so I think we have that in Matthew chapter 5 being refuted. You might flag Leviticus 24, 17 to 23, the same principle is found. And so the punishment was to be commensurate with the offense. Make sense? All right. Say again. Leviticus 24, 17 to 23. All right, let's go to chapter 20, Rules for Warfare. Yes, ma'am. Yes. All right, good point. Yeah, he has to remain there for him to be safe. He's not safe from the avenger. And so I'm not 100% sure, but I am, if you put me on the jury, I'm not going to convict him if he killed him on the way until I've seen the law that says so. I'm not. Yeah. he better put his tennis shoes on and run fast. All right. Let's talk about the rules of warfare. Now, let's see if we can make it through this. This has to do with warfare that they're obviously, they're going to start with war. They're going to have to go across and conquer the land. They're going to fight, etc. But there's some new information here that we haven't seen, and we'll try to flag that when we get there. Let's start with verses 1 to 4 about putting your trust in the Lord. In verse 1, when you see your enemy is going to have what? They got chariots, horses, and more troops. Yeah, they got more people. Now, you think how that must have been if you put yourself in the place. We've got 1,000 troops, we've got 1,000 horses, and we've got 1,000 chariots, and they've got twice as many of everything. And their horses look more healthy, and their chariots look newer, and their men look like they're stronger. I don't know how this is going to go. And yet, don't be afraid of the numerous army because of the Lord your God is with you that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. If he brought you through the land of Egypt and brought you through the Red Sea, he can fight this battle for you. All right, that's verse 1. Now, verses 2 to 4, the priests are going to have to remind them of something. When they get ready for battle, the priests are going to gather them. The priests are going to make a lecture. What are they going to say? The Lord's going to fight for us. That's the point of verses 2 to 4. You're on the verge of a battle, for the Lord is going to go for you, to fight for you, and against your enemies, to save you. And so that gets us through verse 4. So don't be afraid, don't be faint, don't back off, put your trust in the Lord. There are some exceptions to going to battle. The first one at verse 5. All right, a man who built a house and hasn't dedicated it, there is a danger, he might get killed in battle. So this passage is, when it's saying God's going to be with you, doesn't mean no one would ever be killed. In fact, they're going to lose some people. In fact, they lost quite a bit over at Ai, didn't they? second battle. But you're going to go into battle unless he come back and someone else dedicate his house. He's exempt from going to this particular battle. He may go to the next one, but not this battle. Secondly, a man has done what? Verse 6. Planted a vineyard. And he might get killed and somebody eat of his vineyard and he not get to eat of it. So he's exempt from this battle. All right, there's a third exception. He's betrothed, but he hasn't married her, and lest he get killed and someone else marry her. And let's add one more that's not in this text. And let's look at chapter 24, verse 5. If a man is recently married, how long could he be before he went to battle? For 1 year. That's not mentioned in chapter 24, but you might flag that right here just for a little information of tying those together. Now, I'm really interested in verse 8. There was another exception, which is kind of surprising. Why would that be a problem? They might not be brave enough, but notice at the end of verse 6, lest, let him go and return to the house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. He will have, finish my sentence, on influence on others. Exactly. We don't need a faint-hearted out there in the battle, because this may be contagious. And we have a whole, it breaks out like a cancer. And we don't want that. If he's faint-hearted and he's fearful, he needs to just go back home, because we don't need that kind of men fighting for us. Would you agree with that? Absolutely. If you're fighting a spiritual battle and you're faint-hearted and you're afraid, just go home. Let the rest of us fight the battle, because we don't need that kind of encouragement. Don't need that at all. And so that's the point here. Now, you might flag verse 8 and later verse 18. God in battle was concerned about influence. God's always concerned about influence. He's concerned about influence from within, verse 8, from without, verse 18. All right. Now, at verse 9, once they get ready for battle, and they've got everybody staying back that's going to stay back, the priests are going to tell them to appoint captains to lead. And that's about all it says at verse 9. So we need leaders, and they're going to appoint leaders. All right. Now, beginning at verse 10, and this is the new information. By new information, starting at Genesis to this point, we haven't seen this yet. That's my reference to new information. That when you go to a city, near a city, and fight against it, and you're going to, I'm going to get ahead of myself, then we'll work back through the verses. I think we have time to do that. Let's get verse 15. This is the key to interpreting this section. If you just read a quick reading, it sounds like you're going to go across over into the river, and you're going to come to the cities, and let's say you come to the first one, you try to make peace with the city, and if they don't make peace, then you fight them, and if they do, then you put them under tribute. He's not talking about that. Look at verse 15. These are cities that are far away, that are not cities of these nations. In other words, the territory that God has promised to give them is not under consideration in these cities that he's talking about. These are cities that are far away, that are outside that region, that are not a part of these nations, but, verse 16, of the cities of these people which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. So there's a contrast between these cities that are being given as an inheritance within that territory of the Hittites, Jebusites, Canaanites, etc., and these that are far away. Because every reference we've seen so far of marching into the city, what were they to do when they get into the cities? Utterly destroy and drive the people out. Don't make a truce with them. But this is talking about making a truce. So this is cities beyond that region. When you ever have a battle that's beyond that region, perhaps this is talking about that expanding that we saw in chapter 19. Make sense? All right, so let's get what he's saying here. When you go to those cities, verses 10 and 11, if they will accept peace, what do? You make peace with them and you put them under tribute. In other words, they serve you. They serve the children of Israel. They're going to pay tribute to you. So you're going to get a tax off of them, and they serve you and they do whatever you want and they do your bidding. Because if they rebel, then you go fight with them and you conquer them. So at verse 10, or verse 11, I'm sorry, you place them under tribute, and but if they will not make peace, then you make war with them. Verse 12. All right, now let's go to verse 13 to 20 to finish the chapter. Here's who and what should be destroyed. And so here are cities that are not your inheritance. If they're part of that which is not your inheritance, like we just saw at verse 16, then you kill every male, and what else do? You save women and children and animals. So that's different than what we see of the part that's your inheritance. This is why I say this is new information. This is new territory for us. Is that making sense? All right. I don't know the answer to that. Among the Israelites, you were a fighting man at age 20. So I don't know the answer to that, Jeff. Good question. I don't know. How was that determined when you go into a city and you're to kill all the males? I'm assuming the same principle, something about age 20 and above, anything below, you'd consider them children. I'm assuming. Yeah, right. Verse 16 to 18 now, here's cities that are your inheritance. I flagged the difference for you a minute ago. Look at verse 16. But the cities of the people that God gives you an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. And so you utterly destroy all breathing things. Now look at verse 18. Why is that done? You don't make tribute with them. You don't make peace with them and put them under tribute. Influence again. What does verse 18 say? Lest what? Well, not only because of the sin, lest they teach you that you do according to their abomination. You keep the people there, you let them survive, you're going to learn their ways, and you're going to practice what they do. You think that happened? I know that happened. Psalm 106 says it did. History says that happened. That's exactly what took place. All right, now let's go to 19 and 20. Here's rules about trees. This is kind of surprising. This is new information. I haven't seen this before that I remember. I may have, but flag me if I've missed that. I think this is new information. Again, speaking from reading from Genesis up to this point, I hadn't seen this so far. What was the rule about trees? You go into battle, and there are going to be trees. If it produces food for man, leave the tree. Why would they even cut a tree in a war? Siege weapons, to build a siege against a city, maybe building a ramp, siege ramp. So as you're building, making your way and building a siege against a city, you may need some of the timber and some wood, and so consequently cut whatever tree you want, but not for food. That was just a basic rule of war. All right, makes sense? Let's go to question number 10. Got about a minute to go. Or 30 seconds. Something practical you take home with you. Punishment should fit the crime. Let's get one more. The faint-hearted are no help. Would you agree with that? That is, when we're fighting against Satan, the faint-hearted are little or no help. They're discouragement. Don't discourage everybody else. Let's stop right there.